U.S. Chess Executive Board open session number two for Saturday, November 10th, 2018, New Orleans, Louisiana. Mr. President.
Okay, so we had a short recess for some personal maintenance items, and so let's step back into the IT discussion. Where we were, I was starting to give a little bit of background there for Ryan's benefit, and maybe for the benefit of the record as well. Mike Nolan has been the IT director for years, and Mike has done a fabulous job with limited resources of continuing, of developing and maintaining this database structure. The problem that we have today, however, is that it is in what is now an antiquated programming language. And so the database structure, the problem is Mike knows how to use it. Finding someone else fluent in that language is getting more difficult and more expensive. Mm-hmm. Also, at some point, the issue of how well that may be supported and how well it may integrate with other programming languages and stuff will become an issue. The other thing is it was written in a way that it is not, without getting into a whole lot of technical description, it's written in a way that it's not the most flexible. To query the database is, modern database structures basically have query language built into them. In what we have, basically if you're going to query it, you've got to write a program to query it. And Mike can do that, but you know, if Mike is not able to do that any longer, we have a problem finding someone who can do that. The other thing, and I want to say this very carefully because I don't want it to come across as a criticism of Mike, it's not meant that way, is that, you know, when you have one person who does a lot of stuff, they know how they did it. And they may or may not be great about documenting how they did it to follow up stuff. And I think there are some cases where one of the things we're doing is making sure we understand the documentation and filling in some gaps that exist because of, you know, sometimes you take shortcuts or you may not really think about someone following along behind you to read it. So part of the process has been, as you were describing, Carol, getting together with Mike to make sure we understand the project documentation. When you're programming, you can document within the program a whole lot. Mike has tended not to do that a lot. So part of the project is simply to very well understand what we got today. And the reason why we need to change the underlying database software is because we need to have more modern software that's much more flexible in the way that you interface with it.
Right.
No one in the office has the capacity to easily do a database query to pull anything out. It just does not exist.
Unless it's Mike has written a...
That's my point. Yeah. So if something comes up and you want to do a new query, it is a major project to get that done. And it involves having to get the IT people involved. And that is not a place that most stuff is at these days.
Right. And I think where we're at right now is trying to understand functions that may not be visible at the top user level of the system, those capabilities that are either hidden or some of the interdependencies between different components of our system, because, you know, we want an integrated system again, but we want to understand how we're currently, those things are currently working together, so we make sure we capture that for the RFP. So this is not just about, you know, adding a new member into the database. It's about how membership classes...
it's about making the database workable.
Right.
At various levels.
And so, but then it, you know, the tool that we're looking at using also integrates with a different content management system. So the web piece of it, and so how we can... use the database to drive content for the web, like ratings reports and top whatever lists and mm-hmm. top lists by state and all of that can be, as it is now, data driven, but we hope it will be a little easier to maintain and run in the future. So mm-hmm. we're all of that, and then the maintenance side is that we have to figure out what it is we want to keep on the old website. I'll call it the old website. You know, certainly all the governance documents, but do we just simply archive that site, or do we clean it up before we archive it? You know, I don't know the answer to that, but we've kept everything. It has something like 50,000 pages of stuff that we have to go through to figure out what we should be displaying more prominently on the public site mm-hmm. and what needs to stay behind the paywall. So all of these things are built into the thinking and how we're approaching creating this new RFP.
And I think that becomes, you know, important to the understanding of what's going on here. In reality, in my opinion, let's say it that way, that's probably a better way to say it. In my opinion, this project is about 8 to 10 years overdue. In reality.
Well, again, this tool we're looking at could very well help short circuit some of the base functionality we as an organization use every day and need to run. And we won't have to develop custom code to create like an events module or membership management or communication or, you know, all of those things are baked in. Where we will need custom software is ratings, TD affiliate area, certainly linking to whatever CMS will be, you know, another thing to be thinking about, and those connections will also be custom. But, you know, the system we're looking at is there are standard reports, but then there's the ability to customize queries on the fly, and you base it on a user's role with that system, so they'll have access to what they're allowed to have access to create a report, and, you know, by checking boxes. I mean, that, mm-hmm. and then they have the report. We won't have to have an intermediary to do that work for us. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of redundancy that goes on in the office because people don't have access to the tools they need to do their job. I mean, it's mm-hmm. that simple. We upload things in the database, and then we create a manual spreadsheet.
Yeah,
because
they can't
access this. So mm-hmm. anyway, any other questions?
So this is really, and this is not anything that's customer facing. You know, so we get stuff in the forums where people are, when are you gonna make these changes on the website? Well, we're gonna, but this other part's got to get fixed first. Mm-hmm. And some of us have actually been saying this for a while, maybe not as articulately as it would have been good to say, but even, you know, when Carol first got on board, one of the things I said, the thing that keeps me up at night is worrying about what happens with this database, frankly. The website of it needs to be updated. I get it, but I don't lose sleep over the website. I lose sleep on the back end.
Because that's our business.
Because that's the business. Mm-hmm. And again, not meaning this, I absolutely do not want anyone to interpret that this is criticizing Mike, because it isn't. But very much, we have had this very critical system dependent on one individual, and it's getting more dependent upon one individual every day. The older the system gets, because the people who will understand the programming language are getting smaller and smaller every day. So that is a problem. You know, I mean, that really, really concerns me. It's, I think, as I told Carol, it's really critical we get this moved while we still have Mike available to us. And Mike has cut down his role. You know, he's wanting to take less of a role and spend time doing some other stuff. I totally understand that. Right. He's been very, very gracious in his willingness to help us do this, And I really do appreciate that. And it's, that's why it's so important to give while he's able to do that and while he's willing to do that, as opposed to, you know, wanting to spend time 6 months of the year traveling in Europe or something, you know, that's important. So anyway, it will not be done soon enough to suit me. I don't mean that again, that's not meant as a criticism of the process. I think it's very important that we get this thing moving. And I'm chafing at the fact that it's taking as long as it's taking, and it has to take as long as it's taking. Agreed. I get it.
Yeah.
But it's the one thing we just got to keep pushing and pushing and pushing to get it done. And all the things Mike was talking about, the contract process, are important, and they may add time to it. I get it. And we cannot let those things bog us down. We may need to do them. That's not my point. But we cannot let it bog us down and lose sight of getting the thing done.
Given the, I'm going to use this language, single point of failure or single point of knowledge of Mike, as part of the contracting process and the solicitation process, is Mike being required to sign some sort of, shall I call it, non-disclosure agreement or something that says that he can in no way, shape, or form provide advice to vendors or otherwise be contracted by a vendor to do the work. In other words, something that's eliminating him from the actual competition itself. Until such time as a contract gets awarded.
I think the technological upgrade that we're talking about takes care of the issue.
Right.
No, but still, the importance of Mike is he's a historical knowledge point for whoever gets awarded the contract.
Right.
Okay?
Oh.
So, what becomes the... Does Mike then hold his knowledge hostage to the awardee so that he starts having to be paid to get that knowledge?
So Mike, we currently pay Mike for his time. He's very generous with his time and charges us almost nothing by the hour. I mean, he really does. He also acknowledged in a conversation we had this week that he will probably be part of the process as we go forward when things are being built out, especially the more custom parts of the system. I think we will retain him until such a time that we can power down the other system completely. I mean, I think Mike's on board with that. He does really want to retire, even though he enjoys dabbling with some of this stuff. He doesn't want to have to be the one who gets the Saturday morning 1 a.m. email or phone call that something's run amok.
Because he is still getting that call.
Yeah.
In our negotiations, as he became an employee, this issue was addressed. And it said that he would provide information and technical support to us.
Yeah. And the data, the download that he's doing with Boyd, you know, we're getting more knowledge. I mean, so there were specific things I asked Boyd to come away with, because Mike was the only person who knew how to do them.
But I'm just trying to look forward to a situation where it becomes Mike's perception that the information he's now providing is not information that U.S. Chess is asking about, but the vendor who's supporting U.S. Chess is asking about. Mm-hmm. And should he be paid for that knowledge, you know, from his perspective? Mm-hmm. And I just wouldn't want to see us fall into a situation where, well, if U.S. Chess asks me that question, I'll give the answer to it. But if the vendor's asking me that question, I'm not going to answer it. You know,
we have
that may not be a concern. But raising it, so.
You're making an assumption that the vendor knows our structure and knows about Mike specifically. I mean, the vendor's point of contact should be the executive director or the project manager that we assign to it. They shouldn't be contacting individual employees, albeit whoever that employee is.
I think it'll become common knowledge that people will know that, oh, if you want to know, just ask Mike. He's the guy who knows.
We've kind of already been through this. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say. And that's worked okay. I mean, is that... I don't know how much you want to get into it. But.
No, I think Mike has done right by us.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, he's not always available when we need him to be, but you know, that's not his role. I mean, so that's part of the problem we're trying to address.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, unless there's other questions, I'd like to move on to the next item that was identified, which is the Director of Development, and I have a more general staff update to go along with that. So everybody knows that we've hired Jeff Isaac as our first Director of Development, and we also brought on board the same day Jennifer Pearson as our Governance Coordinator. Jen returns to us having been an editorial assistant part-time for Chess Life in the past, and she actually was the person who dealt with the delegates call. So her knowledge, or at least the lingo of what the governance coordinator deals with, in large part was already familiar, and that has already shown to be paying off. She has hit the ground running. In fact, Kathleen Collins, who is transitioning into retirement, will be done the end of November. But is turning in her computer early next week. She'll only be available on a phone basis as needed by Jen. So the transition has been super quick. It's less than a month. And Jen has, you know, she's just hit the ground running. This was a real good hire for us. Jeff, too, has hit the ground running. I think he fully understands that we really are starting from ground zero in terms of any kind of development program, you know, from the data we have about potential donors to our internal processes for supporting a program, right down to, you know, the thank you letters that we send out to people who give, you know, all of that he's going to put his touch on. Right now, he is working on a year-end giving campaign for us, and we expect that will drop the very end of November, so right after Thanksgiving, before the 1st of December is the plan. And we have segmented our list of potential givers rather than doing a, you know, 10,000 mailing that probably wouldn't yield anything except a big bill from our mail house. We're also planning to participate in Giving Tuesday, which is a popular way to raise awareness about your mm-hmm. organization. I don't know how effective it is at actually raising money without a really large coordinated effort. But again, this is part of our culture change, and every opportunity we get to remind people that we are a C3, an organization that accepts charitable contributions, is good for us to be doing. The other thing that I've got Jeff working on is the case for support for U.S. Chess. Now, I know that the contractor that we hired in the past to do some development advising for us had worked on a case for support, and well, I think the brochure, you know, getting us something was a good first crack. That wasn't really a case for support. That was a collateral piece that we could use when interfacing with prospective donors. A case for support really outlines the rationale for why an organization is seeking funds. And in some way, it's more of an internal document. It describes your messaging. It talks about the different types of approaches you might make to different audiences, the different programmatic things you're seeking money for. So I imagine it's going to be a 12 or 16-page document, not a brochure like we had before. So in talking to Jeff, he confirmed what I felt, but I wasn't sure I was right, that some of the work that had been done for us on contract was really quite incomplete, and did not, it got us part of the way, but did not get us the things that we both thought we had in what was passed down from Gene, for example, to me. So Jeff is trying to jumpstart that, articulate that case, and that will be a collaborative effort. Myself and Dan and Jen Shahadi will all be involved in developing that. And then, of course, we'll work with the development committee to sort of get their, not approval, but their review and blessing, if you will. So on the staff front, made a decision to do all staff reviews this time of year rather than missing that one that comes in April, you know, because it was their anniversary. So between September 15th and November 30th, we're going to just do everybody's staff review on an annual basis. So that's, I'm happy to report mine are done. The others are well underway as well. One thing I think that for me is particularly gratifying from working with the team we have at US Chess is that as we've tried to step forward, you know, towards supporting the mission that the board has put forward, different people on our staff are sort of stepping up to take on new roles, and they're doing it without being asked. So Boyd taking on this IT stuff, this was an offer from Boyd. I didn't ask him to do that. So Jen Shahadi has expressed interest in taking on a programmatic oversight over the women and girls in chess, and also help with the fundraising for that because she's already well established in that area. That's on top of what she does with our website and whatnot. And she stepped forward. And Deborah Robeson, our senior accountant, has also expressed interest in learning more about the fundraising side and offered to support Jeff from the office side to get things done that you know, need to be done that he might be able to hand to her. And what that says to me is that people want to be part of the change, you know, that they're excited about where we're going. And, you know, most people don't willingly sign up for more work, but there's something happening, and it makes me feel really good that I've got their support. And we really do have a great team backing the organization. So and, you know, those who do get asked to take on additional duties seem to do so willingly. So, you know, that's happening as well. And we're shifting some things around, breaking down some silos. Everybody seems to be on board. So
it's part of the evolution of a life of an organization that says not only do they have a personal commitment to it, but they also have embraced the mission and the function as part of what they believe is important to themselves as people. And that says a lot about the leadership environment that you're setting within the organization to allow that to, you know, to really sort of flourish, and to do so without it being second-guessed. You
know? Yeah, it feels really good right now. I think people are... they've been waiting a long time to be supported, I think, in a way where they can grow, and that's a good thing. Any questions about staffing stuff?
One thing that we, and I think we're going to talk some more about some of this in the closed session, but one thing I think we do have to be prepared for coming up sooner rather than later, and it just recognizes the longevity of some of our people in the office. You know, we have an aging team in CrossFit, so you know, we're probably going to be called on sooner rather than later to do some other staff additions there as folks decide that they're ready to retire and do other things. And so I think we just need to be prepared for that. It will give us some opportunities, perhaps, to restructure how certain things are being done in the office as folks move on. And that's going to be a loss to the organization. We're going to lose a lot of institutional knowledge of what's going on there. So part of the project, too, is to make sure that we get institutional knowledge captured from some folks who've served the organization for a really long time. You know, we've got people in Crossville who moved down from New York to work there. And so, you know, we're going to need to, we just have to be prepared because that's coming.
Yep.
You know, given the age of some of the folks involved.
Yeah, one of the things that Judy Meisner in particular and I have been talking a lot about is cross-training people. Because, you know, things, one person is designated as the person who sends out all email blasts for the organization. Well, that person was on vacation last week. And we needed two email blasts set out. And they weren't so important to, you know, call that person in up on vacation and say, can you do this? But, you know, it certainly is something that other people can and should be able to do. And so we're, you know, that cross-training is really, really important to us running effectively. Moving on to another area I want to talk a little bit about, and that is membership services. You know, we're developing programmatic stuff, but we still have, you know, 90,000 plus members that we need to support. Sharon McClure, who's one of our membership assistants, it largely is responsible for the membership appreciation program, and it needs a refresh, and Sharon is taking a look at that, talking to some other staff, and making some suggestions for rolling out an update to that plan. I don't know if that'll happen in 2019 or 2020, but it's something that's coming, and I think it'll be much stronger and more robust. You know, from my perspective, like Ryan, I've been doing some work with our membership committees or our committees, clubs, women's, accessibility, and top players even, college. The thing that I'd like to report on, though, and we're very excited about this, the new chair-elect, I guess, of the college committee and I have been talking for months now about doing a high school fair at the high school Scholastic
National
event in the Chicago area. And basically, we have room for 10 tables. We're going to be inviting colleges and universities from a 250-mile radius, charging them a nominal fee to set up a table in the Skittles room and provide that as a service to kids and their families who may not be looking at schools in the Midwest but have an opportunity to connect with a college they may never have considered. And, you know, to me, that would add a lot of value to some of the downtime that that goes on at that event. So our initial year is a modest target. If our response is overwhelming, we can do 10 on Saturday and 10 on Sunday. And, you know, we're charging $100. We've got a draft brochure in development right now, and we'll be going, doing that outreach the end of December into early January. So I think that's an exciting opportunity. The election committee, I've been talking to Ken Ballou on a couple of items. One is, you know, moving away from a mailed paper ballot, and gave him some guidance on a software package that could work for us. He was going to take that back to the election committee. I'm not involved in those discussions. But the other thing that had come up during this most recent election, and, you know, we're not sure how many candidates we're going to have in the next election, but doing something like an online town hall, like using Facebook Live, or where the candidates can be asked questions. People can submit questions in advance. You know, they can do a 5-minute opening and then field questions for why they want to be on the EB, what their vision is, and it would be an opportunity for people who don't necessarily participate in our governance because they don't know where these conversations are going on in the forums to interact and get involved and perhaps attract a newer generation to the process. So Ken Ballou, much to my gratification, really liked the idea, and so I think we're going to try to roll that out in the early going for the next election.
I think that's a great idea.
The one thing you may want to think about is just like we have a process within the forum to weed out the knuckleheads, we may want to have a procedure where if you want to have a question, your question has to be submitted in advance.
That's exactly what we're going to do. That's what I said.
Yeah, definitely.
And then the question gets read as opposed to the person's asking the question live.
Right.
I was on the board for a number of years and actually was the president of a nonpartisan public policy debate organization in Louisville called the Louisville Forum. And we never had a problem getting people to come and be part of forums there because we allowed questions from the floor, but they were all submitted in writing and they were read by a member of the board.
Right.
And you just weeded out the when did you stop beating your wife questions.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about, right? You know,
where they don't really want to be questioned. I heard you sexually abused kids in elementary school. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it eliminated that kind of stuff, and it really made it work a lot better. I mean, you know, and so people would appreciate that, and we'd get politicians who'd show up, and we'd get really good folks willing to come precisely because that was
right. And I haven't asked Ken, but Ken might make a good moderator. I mean, he would.
He may not. I think there would be a conflict of interest with his duties on the committee because he would be filtering in his own head what gets asked and how it gets asked.
Mm-hmm. That's good true. Point. Good point.
So maybe it ought to be like Dan ought to be the moderator.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, or Jennifer.
Dan would be
maybe
excellent.
Not Jennifer, but somebody.
Yeah.
Somebody who's a part of.
Yeah. Good idea.
Who you work, you control.
So anyway, I think, again, it's part of this is cultural. Again, how do we engage our younger members to participate in all aspects of this organization? So it's maybe it'll be seen as a step forward. And finally, for the open part of the meeting, just wanted to let you know that we've had some continuing conversations with the Alzheimer's Association about how we might engage both the Accessibility Committee and myself have had conversations, and there's some interest by the Alzheimer's Association and our senior committee in also finding some collaboration opportunities. We've also connected with another association on the on some etiquette for people with disabilities. They've already sort of outlined what's appropriate, how to behave when you come across somebody who's disabled, and we're gonna borrow their work. We've gotten permission to borrow their work and incorporate it in what the Accessibility and Special Circumstances Committee is doing. That's what they want. They want that information disseminated. So, we're branching out to touch other communities when our issue sets kind of cross paths. We have two research studies that we're participating in. One, I think we talked about when we were in Louisville. They have gotten IRB approval. This is a survey that's being done through Geisinger Health in central Pennsylvania, and it's basically looking at study habits for chess and rating. So, and then there's another one that has been approved by the ratings committee. I guess Mark Glickman serves as an informal IRB, and that's a study coming out of Stanford. They're going to be looking at our ratings database. It's not going to be a survey. So, we're handing them some de-identified data for them to assess, and it's related to coaches and whatnot. So anyway, I think, word is out and people are approaching us for different things, and it's a great time to be at US Chess.
That's great. Sounds super.
Okay.
Does that basically complete your report?
It does.
For the open
now.
Session.
For
we
now.
Have some closed session items. Before we move on to the financial report with Chuck, we'll discuss this next part, and it'll be obvious why I say this in closed session a little bit more. But Carol mentioned about the reviews being conducted internally of our team members. And Carol has been with us now for a little more than a year, and she and I have discussed her review of her work over the last year. We're not prepared to do that this weekend. We would have been a little more prepared to discuss it in greater detail. I've done some preliminary work on it, but with some of the recent medical issues I've faced, I was not able to devote as much time to that as I would like to have to bring stuff to you all. We will discuss that process a little bit more in closed session. We have done executive director reviews before. I will say that one of the challenges is that when Carol came on board, the executive board at the time did not sit down and give her a direct set of goals and things to accomplish. So we're basically working off of the job description in the hiring. That's what we're going to have to do this year. And I think that's apt. I mean, that's really what we wanted to get done. And then as we go into the next year, we'll be working together to develop a little more refined set of goals by which to review Carol's performance in the next year. We really didn't do that last year at all because we were in transition, so we really didn't do a review of Jean at that point. I'm not sure we did one a lot the year before because Jean at that point had already told us internally that she thought she'd taken the organization as far as we could go, and we were starting the process in 2 years ago of doing the hiring process that led to us hiring Jean. So I'm not sure even at that point we did a lot of that evaluation. The last time we really did this was the year before that, and most of that process happened within the personnel committee of the board. I think that we want to expand that a bit this year. The personnel committee the last several years has been the president, the vice president, and the vice president for finance, I think. And certainly I wouldn't want to exclude from the process Mike, who was so involved with helping onboard Carol, and the two of us worked really closely with Carol to do that, and to not pull those impressions. We just don't need to restrict it to that this year. Yeah. Having said that, we've got two new members of the board who probably can't contribute very much to that process. You know, they just don't have the working with Carol. So I think it's going to fall upon the five of us who are the continuing board members to largely do that. And I think we'll do it as a committee of the whole, but I think it's really up to the five of us to do that evaluation. And Ryan and Randy are welcome to throw in comments, but they just don't have the background much to be real useful there. No offense, Ryan, I don't mean it that way.
Plenty taken.
Yeah, exactly. They'll be much more integral to that next year because they'll have the experience under their belt of working with Carol through that period of time. All they can give us now is general impressions. So that's one of the things that will be on our agenda for the January meeting is to resolve that. We will be doing some work on it between now and then. And we will talk about process a little bit more in closed session. Okay, is that okay to everybody?
Yeah.
The next thing on our agenda is the financial report from the Vice President of Finance, Mr. Unruh.
Yes, indeed. I want to tag along with what Carol said. What a wonderful time to be involved with the finances of this organization and with the stability of the organization. I mean, it just... These are definitely good times, and we'll talk a little bit about it by looking at our September numbers. Our September numbers are old right now, and I'm going to put them up, but a couple things I want to mention. When I say old, is October is going to be a real transition. We added staff, we've added mission, and we're starting on the IT.
We paid for the cadet, and we paid for the World Youth, and we paid for the Olympics.
Yes, but we were prepared. As we see in September, we're running a huge surplus, with the concept of preparing for these expenses. This isn't hitting us unannounced. And that's what it demonstrates. Our real organic growth is somewhere around 4%. I'm glad to see it in the regular membership that we have 12,000 above budget. That's really good. I mean, the adult membership, regular membership. So we're very solid there. We've been solid in that category for more than 20 years as far as membership dues. They've been solid. Where we're talking about now is changing our mission a little in this transition as we we look at the new blood or the new person filling the directors. What do you call it? Director of programs, or what is his official
director
title?
Development.
Development. Good. I'll lift some more weights on his behalf. welcome him aboard, but we're going to find that it'll still be the membership dues and that will support our mission for the next 6 months, because most of what I see on the 990 is targeted donations, and I really expect that that'll be the best way to start the sale, is targeted donations. Are you going to support this program, programs that are membership support? General donations, love to see them, but we'll just have to develop those in the next 6 months. So we're going to be working off of our normal revenue streams, and those should be adequate to see us through for the next 6 months, and then we'll evaluate where we are and what we've done on the development side. This is a good time of the year. We've gone through the summer, and we have our surpluses, and it's really on the expense side, so we have to say thank you to our staff and to everyone. Because the expense side is a strong side. The delay of implementing our IT has created an additional push in the surplus. But our organic growth is probably 20-25% of most of our revenue change over the years. We're not getting a lot of organic growth yet. In revenue, membership's different. Membership, dollars per membership has been steadily retreating since the 90s because we've become more scholastic. So those items, when I talk about revenue being stable, doesn't mean membership's stable or membership has increased. Mm-hmm. So expect changes in October, more in line with the budget. We'll have that out soon. And what I would like to move on with is, you've had time to review all the documents and that, if you have any questions on our finances on September. September was a very good month. I would like to talk a little bit about where we're going with the reserve fund. We were very much wanting to stay in cash after September, and there are reasons staying in cash while we're forming our team. We now have a task force in place, 5-member task force, and we're preparing to move into the markets. But something, being in cash hasn't been all wrong lately. And the reason, this is what's really going on in the world. This is a chart of the US dollar weekly in terms of American assets. For all the rhetoric out there about government and the government policies and the bickering, the world loves the US dollar. And as the US dollar goes up, everything, all of our earnings in US dollars will get stronger, buys more goods and services on the world market. So a cash heavy or US dollar heavy portfolio has not been the worst place to be. It's been a very good place to be in the markets. Now, why? Currently in our Ameritrade Reserve Fund, we're getting a little less than 1%. So we have a plan. That plan, if we look at the chart, is to divide up our reserve fund into categories or sectors. We can see that we want to stay cash heavy because of the nature of the fund. The nature of the fund is to provide immediately if perhaps something happens this spring and we need funds. We have an event that requires immediate funds. Well, we want a certain amount in cash, and what I'm going to recommend to the task force is 25% in cash. Preferred indexes, what are preferred indexes? They are interest-sensitive indexes. Preferreds are the bonds of banks and insurance companies. Very solid, long-term instruments. This is an index. An index means that it is from some preferreds from shipping, some preferreds all from banks, some from insurance companies, some from utilities. So we get diversification. What type of response can we get in yield? Well, it's not a whole lot in index, 5.6%. We can see that our cash deposits in the bank, if we went for 1 year now, we might be able as an organization to get 2.5%. We'll most likely have to go, we'll go through, U.S. Chess will go through Ameritrade and try to buy a CD, a 1 year CD.
Senior. So the average weighted is the current contribution to the
total
overall percentage.
So you're jumping ahead on me, but that's a good point.
Of what Chuck's proposing.
Yes, this is what we're proposing.
None of this has been done yet.
None of this has been done. When in designing this type of portfolio, this is a very conservative portfolio. Capital preservation, that's a big item with us. This is a reserve fund, capital preservation. Income in dollars, not in capital gains. So we're going to be really interest sensitive and take our money in U.S. dollars, dividends, yield. Preferred indexes yield 5.5. You say, why is the U.S. Treasury only yielding the 10-year 3.18 this morning? And these indexes yield more. Well, these indexes are on corporate entities.
So they are higher risk.
They're higher risk. Now, they're looked upon as higher risk in U.S. Treasuries.
I mean, yes. Risk is relative. The lowest risk investment one can make worldwide over the last 50 years has been U.S. government bonds.
Absolutely. That is the mainstay of the definition of no risk. But there's even risk in U.S. bonds.
There is.
That's the risk-free return. Now, the next category is a little different. They're senior notes. Senior notes, in the closed-end fund market, there are senior note strategy funds. And those senior note strategy funds are funds that when interest rates adjust, the funds follow the interest rate. So they buy notes that are known as variable notes. If interest rates go up, the senior note strategy fund will adjust accordingly, whether it's 6 months or 1 year, and we'll see, especially in terms of real, as rates accelerate, if they would lose control of the yield currently, in 1 year, closed-end funds would adjust to the new rate. So we're not locked in. In a normal bond, if rates go higher, the capital of the bond will go lower. And that's our preferred indexes. Most likely, if interest rates go up, preferred indexes go down. We've seen that in the LMA Trust. Senior notes, that's a different strategy. That is like a variable note. International markets.
Chuck, before we get off of that, you all may know this. I don't want to insult anybody's intelligence, but what Chuck has behind there says CEF. He mentioned it. That means closed-end fund. A closed-end fund is a little different from a mutual fund in that a mutual fund, you give the fund manager money and they buy more stuff. You ask the fund manager to send you money back and they send you a check after they sell stuff. A closed-end fund buys a bucket of stuff and then its shares are traded on an exchange. So if you want to buy into the closed-end fund, you buy shares from me because I own them. If you want to sell your shares, you've got to find somebody else to buy them. You don't call up the closed-end fund managers say, send me a check, he just laughs at you. So it makes their world a little more stable. They're not dealing with funds inflows and outflows. They're just investing in a pool of money. So that, okay. In a simplified Thank way, you. That's the difference.
There are a lot of advantages, but I won't go into the weeds. Yes. I will not touch mutual funds, but I have a portfolio of closed-end funds.
One thing about a closed-end fund is generally the administrative expenses of running the thing are much less expensive because they're not trying to sell more shares in the thing and they're not dealing with owners getting redemptions and all that kind of crap. Yeah, it's less,
okay.
less involved.
I mean, so I look at this and I'm going to I'll show an example of a closed-end fund. I didn't want to get into the weeds, but how do we select them? That's a factor. International markets right now are down 30%. Not to have something in the international community, such as a international utilities in pipeline, DPG, that yields 10% as a closed-end fund. We should have some exposure, and that's our exposure in a weighted sense. It's a small amount. We're saying international markets 4%. We could buy PID, which is your International Achievers Fund, and that International Achievers Fund has a 4%, and it's quite a few large oil companies in it that you'd recognize, Shell, BP. So we're looking for very solid international dividend growth. We're not looking for much growth in this portfolio at all. This is more of an interest-sensitive portfolio.
How are those international market options, or maybe the bad word to use, but parts of the portfolio, how are those international markets investments screened by us from a standpoint what those portfolio managers are actually investing in?
Well,
they're not investing in something that is counter to our nonprofit organization's mission, or they're investing in something going on in Iraq that the U.S. government is against, or
right,
something like that.
Or Wynn Resorts in Macau.
Yeah.
That might not be something we want to invest in. I understand your question. I'll demonstrate that on another screen.
Okay.
I'll answer your question. So we want a little exposure. This is just overall international markets, international strategies, very conservative. Probably utilities that are in England. It will have all types of international exposure, maybe GSK. GSK, of course, is GlaxoSmithKline of Britain. Santa Fe of another out of France. So we'll recognize the names of these corporations when we look into it. Equity strategy funds, this would be a fund like BIF. BIF has 32% Berkshire Hathaway in it. Very nice, great earnings. Right now the yield's 3.79%, but if it goes to 4 historically in the next little cycle dip that we think has returned going into December, we might be able to buy something like it, BIF with 10%. Absolute great growth in that through Berkshire Hathaway. Over 30% of their fund is invest it with Warren Buffett. Treasury funds, we're talking about TLT, which is the iShares Treasury, yields about currently 2.65, but it's a collection of 20-year funds. Why do we want to own Treasury funds as a tax status that we don't pay taxes? What we find in a credit crunch, for the reasons that you mentioned earlier, the risk-free, if there was an absolute credit crunch going on, we see in 2008, 2009, that investors run to treasuries. The treasuries actually were the stable part of the market in 2008, 2009. In fact, treasuries went up in bond price while the rest of the market collapsed in the credit crunch. So we should have a few treasuries, long-term treasuries, in this portfolio. Total return funds. Total return funds, We're talking at this point in total return funds, there's a little exposure everywhere in the bond markets worldwide. We're not talking about a total return equity fund here. We're talking total return preferred funds. Now, at 4.22%, we're not looking for anything real risky. Not huge risk in this portfolio. What about a total return fund? I'm going to go over here and see if I have it. This is, first I'm going to show, this is an important chart. Get it wrong, get too risky, get caught at the top, takes 20, 14 years between cycles just to recover. From the Great Depression on to get back to where they were in 1929 was 25 years. We don't want to get this wrong. We're at the top of the markets right now. So if it appears that the portfolio is a little too conservative, that's why. What other market are we at the top of? Here is the real problem that is on the minds of many investors. We're at the top of the 10-year bond interest. This is the yield of the 10-year. It's sitting at its yearly high, waiting for the next move that's going to occur in the economy. For those that maybe don't follow the markets, we've been in a 30-year bond bull market. We're no longer in that channel. We're out of that channel, and we're threatening to break higher on yield. That, the Treasury yield breaking out is very negative to fixed income.
Because it means rates are going higher, so existing bonds are worth, that pay a lower interest rate, are worth.
So having a little cash around makes sense as interest rates continue higher. And I'm not forecasting they are. The chart's saying we're moving steadily up. The dollar's getting stronger. So we react to those type of inputs. Now, let's go over and look at something. Mix a little bit of LMA in here. Notice the volatility now in the portfolio. This is a weekly. So we're going to see the volatility, recent volatility in this weekly. The dark line represents accumulated dividends. We've accumulated 24,000 in dividends. Every month we're accumulating 1,500 to 2,500 on the quarters. Quarters are really, really good. But the volatility has picked up. It looks unbelievable. We're no longer on that trend line, but we're still profitable. We have not touched our capital, even on any of the swings. This has all been money we've made that it goes back and forth. Back in September, right here, we were up $31,000. In a matter of 4 weeks or so, or 5 weeks, we were down to 9,000. In the last 2 weeks, we're back to 19,000 in gains. Why all the volatility? There's a struggle in that market I talked about. The rising dollar, rising interest rate. Fed Chair Powell came out, said he's going to stick to his hawkish views, basically. And 81% chance of another interest rate increase in December, and a forecast for three more in 2019. That's important as fixed income investors, because as the rates go up, so does the competition for our preferreds. Competition, I should say, that it's competition to the preferred index, it's competition to the Treasury. And all those rates have to adjust by the capital coming down. So we're seeing wild capital swings. What about this thing called quantitative tightening? This was the beginning of our portfolio, right where you see, I have it on the screen, the star. It was back in July of last year when they announced quantitative easing. And since then, the headwinds have us moving sideways on total gains. The opposite of quantitative easing is quantitative tightening. Quantitative tightening was one of the main causes of the Great Depression.
Yeah.
It was the idea that we're going to wring all the excesses out of the